Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled In God's Name, Primitive Accumulation and Power Wars in West Africa Today. The talk is delivered by Dr. Caroline Ifeka.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome back from Easter 2014 to the seminar series Work in Progress in the Social Sciences. It gives me great pleasure to welcome tonight Dr. Caroline Ifeka, who is giving a paper entitled In God's Name, Violent Youth, Primitive Accumulation and Power Wars in Nigeria's Illegal and Legal Economies. Dr. Caroline Ifeka, PhD London, currently lives in Australia. She was a lecturer in anthropology at University College London and senior lecturer, Australian National University, Canberra. She spent two decades since 1991 working with development and conservation NGOs in the Niger Delta and the center of the Republic of Nigeria. She has been awarded research grants by the British Academy and the Leverhulme Trust on traditional cosmologies, rituals, and power in southwest Cameroon and in Nigeria, as well as research grants by Ford Foundation and the International Institute of Education to study the impacts of violence on non-capitalist economies. She was awarded a fellowship at the Centro Incontri Umani in Ascona, Switzerland in 2009-2010. She is currently writing up a report on violence for the Federal Republic of Nigeria, as well as other academic papers. She is a fellow emeritus faculty, Australian National University. So, Caroline, welcome to the University of Malta, and we look forward to what you have to say.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I would like to say a couple of things on a more personal kind just to start, which is that I've lived in Nigeria, as Paul was saying, for a long time. And I've seen the changes, and they're pretty devastating. But the country remains, in terms of its kind of structural default lines of the distribution of power, its monopolization by an increasingly greedy ruling class, the impoverishment of the masses, that was already set within the colonial era, but it has become cumulatively exacerbated over the last, 40 years or so, 50 years since independence in 1960. So I am a former Marxist, and I still practice Marxist analyses of a fairly sort of simple kind, because I believe that they give you a really clear kind of approach. Whether that approach is right or wrong is another matter, but at least it makes some sense of quite a lot of the issues that I have to discuss today. So I have dedicated this paper to impoverished Nigerian women, men, youth and children. Precious lives brutalized by ruling class thieves engaging in war against the impoverished majority by illegal accumulation of public funds. Lives exterminated by the state's armed forces' peacekeeping operations. Lives incinerated by militants funded by state and extra-state actors to effect ethno-religious cleansing in God's name for land, pasture, capital and power. So I'll begin with a little bit on ethnography and political violence. Today, about one-third of the world's states engage in some form of political violence. That is capital punishment, torture, counterinsurgency, famine, police brutality, genocide, human rights violations, armed conflict, that is war between political communities within and beyond the nation state. In the 1950s and 60s, Fanon, Torres, Cabral, Guevara, Machel and other highly educated revolutionary activists in South America and Africa developed holistic analyses through their own passionate political engagements with whole societies suffering from colonial and post-colonial oppression. African guerrilla leaders in those days were idealistic radicals, socialists who had uplifted themselves through university education in Europe or America into a mission-educated elite. Abandoning peace for violence, they fought with guns acquired at second hand for their people's freedom from political oppression, illiteracy, and early death. Contemporary militant leaders and their followers in West Africa and Nigeria are largely home-educated, some in madrasas, others in dysfunctional government schools and universities, while some are barely literate in Arabic, Hausa, or English. Today's extra state, that means beyond the nation state in other states, today's extra state Islamist organizations operating in Nigeria and the West African Arid Sahel are equipped with a mix of brand new and used modern weapons, purchased in part with blood money from the non-legal narcotics, sex, and gun-running trades. Contemporary desert warriors, in alliance with or independently of narcotic traffickers and money launderers, have developed non-legal power systems, armies, and economies of accumulation, over which the bourgeois nation-state lacks direct control, and which it therefore determines are criminal or illegal. These non-legal political, military, and commercial networks of capital accumulation run parallel to and intersect with those the state determines are legal because it can regulate them, or it thinks it can, through its taxation, legal, and banking systems. Illegal funds are recycled by the legal global economy's banks. Illegal persons recycle themselves into socially acceptable personalities with street cred in bourgeois society. This is just a photograph culled from the internet of Osama bin Laden and somebody else. So since legal and non-legal channels of capital accumulation and political power are part of one global economy, it makes sense that we adopt an holistic perspective and examine the part in relation to the whole. A wide-angle lens enables us to move beyond neoliberal analyses that assume troublesome Islamist or Christian youth shoot innocent soldiers or rob police armories because they dislike the soldier's ethnicity or religion. An early example of holistic analysis of poor people's wars against corrupt states for clean governance is Ibn Khaldun's Historical Sociology of Medieval North African Polities. He argues that periodically, from beyond the fringes of civilization, nomadic camel-riding warriors swept in from the desert, brandishing the sword. Once arrived in oasis town or coastal entrepôt, they killed and imposed political power sanctioned by the one god Allah, whose jihadist warriors cleanse societies of corruption and conflict, restoring social cohesion, that is, asabiyya. The ideal state, Ibn Khaldun argued, is an institution which prevents injustice other than such as it commits itself. So that's a fairly kind of cynical view. And Ibn Khaldun was writing in about 1400 and something. The conceptual framework and argument that I'm going to put forward in this presentation. Conceptual framework and argument. My field data was gathered in 1 to 4 months periods from 2009 to 13, mainly in Plateau State, central Nigeria. I should explain that I don't speak Hausa, and there's reasons for that, but I rely on my Christian Biron driver, who is fluent in Hausa, speaks good Fulfilde, that's the language of the Fulani people who were formerly nomadic cattle keepers, and now they're much more sedentarized and they herd cattle over much more limited distances than previously. He speaks good Fulfilde and he passes for a Hausa man. I can go to Nigeria easily, well, at least until today, perhaps. I don't know what will happen after this, because I'm a Niger wife, once married to a Nigerian, who is now late, as they say. That means he has passed over. I'm working in and around the small market town of Barkin Ladi. I've put it up there somewhere. There we are, Barkin Ladi, which is about 35 kilometers southwest of Jos, the capital of Plateau State. Barkin Ladi is a Biron-dominated multi-ethnic town of Muslim, Hausa Fulani, and Christian ethnic groups. Biron, their name is up there, there's about 400,000 Biron in Plateau State and sort of neighboring states. Biron see the town of Barkin Ladi as owned by them. It's their town. That's what they think. The principal study village is in the Barkin Ladi local government area. It is a multi-ethnic settlement called R, I'm calling it RM, dominated politically by Christian Biram, first settler landowners, though every day their dominance is challenged by demographically more numerous Muslim-free Fulani who own more capital and cash and who have more numbers in the village. About 50% of the village population is Muslim Fulani. They have very large families. Some of the more senior Fulani have got about 30 children. The fieldwork is not easy and is not noticeably safe. As well, I have found it very difficult to learn what is going on inside militant youth groups, their decision-making and leadership processes, their values and beliefs, so as to answer some important questions. Examples of important questions. Christian Biram and Muslim Fulani youth are each protecting their communities by revenge cycles of killing. So how do they justify this terrorizing violence? Do area boys, that is, petty criminals, in town and in the village, concern themselves with the legitimacy or otherwise of violence to protect livelihoods based on armed robbery and political assassinations? How can Islamists, as Izala Salama Diya and the Boko Haram leadership, justify killing innocent civilians and the capitalist state's security forces in order to achieve their proclaimed goal of an Islamic revolution in Nigeria? How can such killing and death, inflicted since 2009 on an estimated 50 to 100,000 civilians, soldiers and supporting militias, be justified? And there's about 1 million displaced people now in central and northern, the northeast of Nigeria. I have been rescued from complete ignorance as to youth subcultures and how they're thinking about violence by several youthful informants, Christian and Muslim, who have given me some information. As well, my anthropological training has enabled me to find a way in, as it were, by focusing on outwardly visible group styles. That is to say, ways of thinking and saying that enact a group sense of itself as coherent and purposive, engaging in violence for moral reasons, and being blessed by ethnic or religious leaders. My broader aim in this paper is to show how ethnographic inquiry can enable an holistic approach to understanding ways in which political violence is shaped by Nigerian society's primary contradiction. Put very simply, in Marxist theory, this is an opposition between capitalist and subaltern classes. The subalterns, that is peasants, in this particular case, peasants, artisans, petty traders, security guards, are exploited by members of the political capitalist class for their land and their unpaid or low-paid labor. These resources contribute to capitalist accumulation, which tends to be concentrated in the hands of the ruling political class. Subaltern peasants, artisanal and petty traders sell products in local markets to buyers, including buyers in bulk, that's merchant capitalists. The latter profit by reselling the product for more than what was paid to the producers. Labor on family farms by youth and women is largely unpaid, as it is in small shops and in carpenters and mechanics workshops, etc. Sometimes casual labor is hired and paid a modest half or full day's wage. So the broader aim is to show how through an ethnographic approach and ethnographic data, we can look at the violence that's happening in terms of an overall theory of what are its basic causes. The basic causes I'm suggesting are due to a conflict, a contradiction, an opposition between what the capitalist political class is doing, accumulating capital by any means, fair and foul, through their political offices and through their command of contracts, dealings with oil and gas companies and so on. So there's an opposition then between the capitalist class and the subalterns who live largely in non-capitalist or who live and work within non-capitalist and simple commodity production relations. So these latter people, the subalterns, they rely upon kinship, clan and ethnic group and the church or else the mosque to enable them to survive in everyday life, because most of them live on less than $1.15 a day. So my more immediate aim is to demonstrate how this class-based opposition is experienced by youth in terms of social relations, rituals, and warrior-like behaviors that are deemed culturally appropriate for sons of the clan, and also how they are experiencing this opposition in terms of the values and ideas that they have to do with their Christian God and their Muslim God, that is, of course, Allah. So I'm suggesting that violent youth construct a common group identity or subculture by drawing on non-capitalist, customary, kin and ethnic-based values, as well as on world religions of the one God and Allah that many adherents believe must be defended against enemy attackers. In sum, the faithful, whether Christians or Muslims, have a religious duty to kill those attacking one's faith. Thus, youth interpret exclusion from economic development and political power through violent action that they justify by invoking ethnic and religious identities of belonging that they have fashioned. So basically, I'm distinguishing between values that the youth are selecting from traditional, politically subordinate, and basically non-capitalist, peasant, farming, artisanal, petty trading cultures of their parents and their home communities, the elders and the ancestors. And also, the traditional values that they draw upon include religious rituals and magical practices that are important in their own clan and kinship group. Secondly, youth draw upon modern, dominant capitalist values that most people at the local level, at the grassroots, identify with the one God of Christianity or Islam, and with some extent with the modern state. The traditional cultural orientation that is important for all of these youth groups of poor subalterns represents a class position of powerlessness in the national political economy. So the traditional signifies, you know, that you don't count for much. The modern cultural orientation, that's to do with the one God and the modern state, signifies possession of power enabling capital accumulation by dispossessing others of their means of production. That's land, hand technologies, traditional knowledge of plants, biodiversity, and so on, so as to enhance ruling class accumulation. I'm now going to go on to discuss Biram and Fulani youth subcultures, and this is based on my own fieldwork. And here is a scene from a riot in Jos in January 2014, and over 200 were left dead. Jos is the capital of Plateau State, and is about 30 kilometers from the village where I've been working, and some other villages as well. So just note the leanness of most of those youth. So, using field notes and memories of NGO work with rural communities in the Niger Delta, and central Nigeria, I shall now present my data on youth subcultures of violence. I explore styles of violence among four groups: Christian and Muslim village and town youth engaging in revenge cycle killings, Islamist extreme violence against the state affected by Boko Haram, and ethno-nationalists battling multinational companies and demanding full control over our oil in the Niger Delta. Though the groups vary in the extent to which their subcultural or their cultural identities emphasize ethnic, religious, or political factors, they all appropriate and blend in varying ways elements from the wider society's popular thinking about ethnicity, customary and modern religion, and about the military in their uniforms equipped with weapons of death. All the groups fund their war campaigns by a mix of wealthy sponsors, politicians, retired military rulers, extra-state Islamist networks, and extra-state trafficking across the Sahel in arms, oil, drugs, body parts, sex, and money. The study village. The principal village I'm working in, I'm calling it RM, is a multi-ethnic faith settlement whose rectangular houses are interspersed with round mud and thatch granaries, all grouped by ethnicity. Families prefer to live close to clan brothers and sisters and co-religionists. There are five ethnic groups in the village. The total population is about 1,250, of whom about 200, including children, are Birom indigenes. That is, first settlers who own or guard the land that they continue to farm, occupy and protect in the name of their ancestors. This is a multi-ethnic women's group that I've been working with, that I've now we've now discontinued because I'm not there enough. So here are some Fulani ladies, some Birom, some Nangu, and I think behind and probably sitting down are some Rumada Fulani who are ex-slaves of the so-called free Fulani who dominate the village. According to 35 focused discussion group informants that I was working with in two villages, cross-checked by key informants, in July to September 2013, the annual cash income of Birom youth, that's males, aged 15 to 34 years, and their elders, aged 34 years and above, was about $185 to $617 per annum. The average was $432 or $1.18 per day below the international poverty line of $1.25 per day. Over 50% of the village population in the principal study village, that's RM, is Muslim Fulani, some of whom possess more cattle in the form of cattle and transport taxis than any Birom resident. Paradoxically, though, both ethnicities are hampered economically by their reliance on capital, tied up in land, that's the Birom, or cattle, that's the Fulani. Both are reluctant to sell or rent land or livestock, though periodically they do so to raise cash, to invest in a livelihood, to pay school fees, to pay bride price for a new wife, to buy sufficient bags of rice to feed a family of 15 to 30 children for the next 6 months. On their part, Fulani sons of cattle-rich fathers and producing their own profitable dry-season vegetables have access to cash in quantities beyond the dreams of most Birom village men and women farmers and youth. Fulani own most of the village's other main income stream sources. These are motorbikes known locally as machines and old Persia taxis ferrying people and farm products to and from markets and down to town in Barkin Ladi. Birom youth fashion their group identity as brave village protectors, successful in battle with Fulani youth by drawing on traditions of warriorhood against Hausa Fulani slave raiders. In the pre-colonial and early colonial period, Birom owned horses. Young riders were known as ferocious horsemen, feared by Hausa and Fulani, defending their land and gods as owners against enemy Muslim strangers and would-be invaders and settlers. Ritual was very important in connecting small Birom communities whose powerful warrior horsemen were bound by sacred oaths to render assistance at short notice to any village that was in trouble from Hausa Fulani invaders. Today, youth communicate by mobile phone with brothers in other places, organizing backup when needed and urgent rescue missions in pickup trucks and local taxis to villages under attack by Fulani and sometimes by their mercenaries. Some of the mercenaries come from Cameroon and Chad, allegedly. Birom boys inhabit a flexible cultural world, dynamic in its patriarchal power relations. Nothing is perceived to endure indefinitely other than the status of family head or the village chief, father's ancestral lands, that's the elders of the fathers, and quit. Quit is spiritual force, energy, and is highly dynamic in traditional Birom belief. This force, empowers Birom warrior youth of all economic classes. Youth told me how they rely on their fathers, that's their elders, for knowledge of the past and use better protection against bullets. So the fathers, that's the elders, are reviving certain rituals. At times, the fathers make offerings at night high up on sacred rocks to God, Dagui. And look, I'm not saying it like a Birom, because hardly anybody who is not a Birom or a Fulani can actually pronounce it. So it's a very interesting language, according to language experts. So the fathers go and make their offerings at night high up on sacred rocks to Dagui, that's God, and quit spiritual energy or power to bring magic that will protect their youth against Fulani bullets and therefore encourage more timid boys to join their brothers on dangerous night patrols, because quite a lot of the youth don't actually want to do all of this. It's too dangerous and they fear being killed. Birom youth have a long tradition of action against unpopular rulers. In 1932, they rose up in a religious uprising against the colonial state. Christian prophets and revivalists, recent converts to mission Christianity, attacked colonial buildings and personnel in the name of recovering lands lost to British and German mining companies. This is tin mining, which is important in the area. These village revolts were snuffed out by fear aroused when 10 of the movement's leaders were publicly executed by the colonial authorities. So now here we have, these are Birom, and they're fleeing from Hausa Fulani ward in Jos in 2011. Note their leanness. This is Birom mothers mourning their dead, because there were terrible massacres and killings in Jos, in the Jos and Jos area, and in villages outside, like the RM village and Chaha, that other village, and so on, in 2011. Note the green leaves, because this is signifying kind of peace and spiritual identification of the mothers and their powers of fertility with the land and with the dead. Also the cross, that's right, and the black dresses, Christian symbols of mourning. And in the same year, at about the same time, here they are, the governor's lodge of Plateau State. The governor has a lodge where he lives, and in Jos, and here they are on the road outside, apparently the lodge was behind, and there they are on the ground, which is the earth, and is of course symbolic of fertility. So there they are bewailing their lost loved ones. The Birom fighting unit is formed in villages whose population is anything from about 100 to 500 or 1,000 persons, including children. Warrior youth also meet in market towns as Barkin Ladi and wards of Jos City, which are owned by the Birom. Village youth refer to themselves and are referred to as youth of RM or another village like Gunandaji or Chaha. They tend to lack a name other than that of their village. Also, groups scale up to include all youth in the area defending their home village or joining campaigns against enemy Fulani camps. For example, there is the recently revitalized Barkin Ladi Birom Youth Association. The apical referent group is the state-level Christian Birom Youth Association, supported by local churches as the Church of Christ in Nigeria, Kokin. Kokin is an extraordinary church, and if anybody wants to ask me about it, please do in the discussion afterwards. Women in the role of mothers of the community play a pivotal role, though it's politically subordinate to those of the men, by raising money and engaging in periodic moves for peace with our Fulani sisters. Youth recruitment, socialization, training of new members and sanctioning is done by means of a few rules about how these young militants who defend the village and who attack other areas where there are Fulani who are attacking them and so on. Youth recruitment, socialization and training of new members and sanctioning is done by means of a few rules supported by the fathers, that's the elders, in the local village council. These rules are backed by informal sanctions to encourage full participation of all physically active youth. That's all those between about the age of 15 to 35. But even the elders, if they're physically active, have to come out and join night patrols because they're 24-24. So everybody gets very tired, so everybody has to push in. And these night patrols are to protect the village, first of all, and to protect women, children, and the elderly against likely expected or expected attack. Notionally, all youth in a group of young men are primus inter pares, that's first among equals, but in practice the strongest, most politically or economically successful in rubbing along with others, and who is most feared by the Fulani and other ethnic minorities, assumes an otherwise ill-defined leadership role. One such young lad is actually my driver's second son, and he's much smaller physically than a lot of the other young men in this village defense and village defense group, which also attacks other people or Fulani who are going to attack them. He's much smaller than a lot of them, but he is greatly feared because he will take on anybody. So, and he's very fit. So economic class inequalities among youth activists are transcended by customary values of a young man's obligation to protect the community and its lands from attack. Economic class inequalities among the young men are also transcended by modern values identifying masculinity with skills in using sophisticated weaponry, like the AK-47, but they haven't got any, but the Fulani have them, but they don't have them, the Birom Christians. Beyond the home village, militant youth countering Fulani terrorism use mobile phones, their only piece of modern technology, other than simple, usually locally made guns, as often as they can afford to purchase credit with which to call for help during expected or actual attacks. Almost invariably, the police are nowhere to be seen, underarmed and since 2001, targeted for death by Fulani in particular. Members of Christian village youth groups vary in their reputed courage, accuracy in firing guns, and skills in outmaneuvering the enemy. Christian Birom youth train periodically in the local bush with retired servicemen, of whom there is a large pool in Plateau State. The servicemen are all Christians, either Tarok or Birom. Here is a Fulani man. He's not necessarily from this area. I don't know where he is from, but anyway, he was on the internet. There are 12 million Fulani herdsmen who are now demanding land rights and political inclusion in 36 states. The thing is that they were previously nomadic, so therefore they didn't have permanent rights of residence anywhere, really. They passed through and then they might come back the next season with their cattle. So that there is this opposition between Fulani who lack the status of being an indigene, a first settler, a landowner, compared to the indigenes like the Birom, who are first settlers, so they say, and they are therefore landlords, and they rent out land and so on to the Fulani. But the fact that they're not land, that the Fulani are not regarded and not defined as indigenes, means that it's difficult for them to claim the right to have representatives standing for election to the local government councils. So they want their own councils. This is Fulani youth from somewhere, probably in northern Nigeria, with cattle who are battling their enemies. Perhaps they're probably cattle thieves. And there's a huge traffic in cattle these days. Here are the negotiators for a peace deal between the Fulani and the Birom, which was said to be very fruitful, but it collapsed a week later. And this is an old-fashioned Fulani hut made of leaves and stems. I'm not sure what that is. But anyway, they're mainly leaves and vegetable fibres that you can get from the bush. And there they are with their traditional herding hats. And here is another young man with his cattle in the rainy season. I'm not sure where that is as well, but it's somewhere. Obviously, you can see it's on the main road. Most Fulani youth in the multi-ethnic village of RM are active members of the fundamentalist Izala Salana Dia Brotherhood. I'll put it up there, meaning peace is here. This is a radical Islamist brotherhood emphasizing Tawhid, or the unity of God. It practices an extreme form of Sunni Islam, rejects democracy and Shia rule. They don't like the Shiites at all. Some Nigerian Izala Salana Dia imams send their Izala sons, quote unquote, surround sons, in the Nigerian nation, or Ummah, to extra state training camps organized by franchise organizations of Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram. For example, they go to training camps in Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, which are states north and then to the east of Nigeria, immediately across the eastern boundary of Nigeria. They also go for in-country training in local camps organized by the Izala Brotherhood, Boko Haram, radical Ardos, and so on. An Ardo is he's a Fulani village or camp chief. Extra state training, arms, supplies, and funding for village Fulani militant youth may have increased since the forging in 2013-14 of a military alliance between Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, which is based in Somalia but also is active in Darfur and Sudan, and Boko Haram. Together, these three organizations now claim to control or to be very active in the vast Sahel, which is north of Nigeria and south of Libya, basically running from east to west to Senegal. They now claim to have total coverage of Sahelistan. They call it Sahelistan. However, another organization may also have a foothold inside Nigeria. A Biram informant told me in 2011 and 2012 that Fulani fighters killed over 40 Biram at a village quite close to Barkin Ladi local government area and subsequently elsewhere. The leading killers were said to be four or five in number. They had white hands. And remember, they're being seen in the dark at night. And so a few people might have had torches initially before the guns started to fire, but after that, you know, there would have been total panic and chaos. They had white hands, wore long dark dresses like kaftans, and had something like writing on their heads. Either these masked gunmen were masquerading as Mujahideen, or they may have been fighters from a group linked to Hezbollah or to Islamic Jihad. Islamic Jihad is a Shiite force active in Lebanon and Palestine, allied with Hezbollah, funded by Iran. It collapsed at one time, but apparently it's active again. It's opposed to Hamas, which is a Sunni group dominating the Gaza Strip in Palestine. In the presence of corrupt, weak states, Hamas and Hezbollah are both famed among people in the Middle East for their welfare services, hospitals, and schools. So this shows you that extremist Islamists can also be very good at the grassroots and looking after their people, providing hospitals, clinics, schools, and so on. So how do people raise funds for their campaigns of battle against their quote-unquote enemies? In the study villages, Fulani and Biram youth raise funds by several non-legal means. For example, by extracting certain parts of dead bodies, especially the heart, the liver, the genital organs, breasts, eyes, tongues sometimes, and so on. They extract these parts from dead bodies for sale to body part trafficking networks within and beyond Nigeria. Parts are reputedly sold fresh or dried, and if they're dried, they're then ground down into a fine powder. They are sold to big ogas, that is to big men or politicians, anxious for sexual rejuvenation, magical powers to detect where enemies are hiding, and to protect ruling class chiefs, politicians, and army officers from attack. Barkin Ladi informants say dried body parts may also be sold to gangster boss men for onward trafficking and value-adding via the narcotics trade across the arid Sahel. Gangs based in this vast expanse of desert link Asian states producing opium, that's heroin, and coca, that's cocaine. Asian states producing opium, that's heroin, and also South American states producing coca, that's cocaine, for example, Colombia. So that the Sahel is like a kind of point of intersection between the South American narcotics production and the Asian narcotics production. And from there, they're going to different parts of Europe, America, and so on. Numerous Biram and Fulani boys undergo the rigors and risks of illegal tin mining as well as other livelihoods linked through the local non-legal economy to extra-state networks in drug trafficking, marijuana production, and also, more recently, amphetamine production. That's another one that's now happening within Nigeria. In this enterprise, they may be directed by Southeast Nigerian Christian Igbo bossmen who dominate the cocaine trade across West Africa. Organ harvesting is reputedly dominated by Hausa Fulani youth and their bosses. That's within Nigeria. I don't know about what happens beyond for that. Boko Haram and Fulani youth, active in Izala and subordinate to the Fulani youth are very close to and interact closely with the executive committee of their own national herder organization, which is a national NGO called Miyeti Allah. And let me just say that Miyeti Allah is actually a powerful player in the violence. So Miyeti Allah, the national herders or national Fulanis, special NGO. They meet up and interact closely with radical Islamist clerics and with village Fulani and town Fulani. So the town Fulani don't really live in the town much, but certainly with the village Fulani youth and their organizations. Now, this is a photograph from the internet of the Islamic Jihad in 2014. They may have visited Nigeria in some of these attacks in 2012 and 13. We just don't know. Or it may be other Nigerian groups which are actually copying that kind of dress and uniform and so on. This is a militant Hamas fighter, and I think she's probably a woman. This is some Kalashnikovs minus the bullet loading barrels. And here, bullet straps, by the way, are very, very popular. They give you a lot of status and prestige as a young man. And this is a rocket launcher from Syria. And they now have one of those, but probably a smaller version, in the principal study village of RM. And this has absolutely terrorized the Christians. And this is a tin mine, very close to the study village. It's part of its land, and it was in an area that was formerly mined by a German tin mining company. Biram informants say that, RM Fulani pay for modern weaponry by extra state trafficking and cattle rustling. So I'm now going to pass on quickly because time is moving on. Fulani youth almost certainly obtain sophisticated weapons from Miyeti Allah, that's the National Herders Organization, which is registered with the Nigerian government. Miyeti Allah works closely with the radical Islamist Brotherhood, Izala Salama Dia, and with radical clerics and the radical Ardos. They meet regularly at a clinic called the Sunnah Clinic in Barkin Ladi town, and it's close to the radical clerics' mosque. There they map out campaigns for another drive to push out Christians and Biram from Plateau State. Similar kinds of meetings and militant Fulani attacks on Christian ethnic groups are going on in other central Nigerian Christian-dominated states, like Nasarawa, Benue, Kaduna. Reportedly, Barkin Ladi youth groups, who are Sunni Muslims, also obtain weapons and ideological and military training from any possible source. They're very opportunistic about it. For example, Boko Haram, they're trained by Boko Haram, the Shiite Iranian proxy Hezbollah, which is significant in Nigeria, through Lebanese, who are businessmen residing in Nigeria and doing banking and so on and trading there. They also get weapons and funding and probably training from Sunnis who supply weapons that were released from armories during the fall of the late Gaddafi. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is another source of funding, training and money, and also Al-Shabaab in Somalia. They may also be in contact with and send Nigerian youth to be trained by the military wing of Hamas. Allegedly, some Nigerian Shiite youth have been trained by Al-Quds, that's the Revolutionary Guards of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, since the late 1970s. Barkin Ladi Islamist youth are also assisted periodically by certain Nigerian politicians, a former military ruler, and numerous retirees, and I know that all of that information to be actually, to the best of my knowledge, is correct. I think I've done that, that's right. Fulani youth in the study village possessed AK-47s and a rocket launcher. I think I've said about that. I'm now going to go on and try and wrap up with youth cultures, styles of violence. So I'm going to treat together the Biram Christian and Fulani Muslim village youth and also the area boys. That's both Christians and Muslims who are based in the town of Barkin Ladi. What is their kind of basic culture? Area boys and vigilantes in central Nigeria constitute their identity in part around non-capitalist society's customary rituals. This is because these promise magical protection against enemy bullets or the Fulani long knives, which most Birom Christian youth now use. The knife is very, very useful because when you've got to be very quiet at night, it's silent. And often, if you see, look at the bodies on the internet pictures, they've got knife wounds right in the side. Birom village militias do not publicize their use of violent methods to deal with the Fulani enemy. The style is intentionally homespun and simple. Well, they haven't got any money to support anything else, really. They just say, go do them, and keep it quiet, hidden from the security agencies and government. So you see, Boko Haram gets a lot of publicity, but these lads don't. It's all quite quiet. Well, most of it, not all. Unlike Boko Haram, these boys' killing fields are relatively invisible to outsiders. When funds and bullets are in short supply, most operations are at night, so advantage is held by attackers, who move and terminate lives silently with long knives. It is impossible and will be highly dangerous to everyone in the attacking or defending group for anyone to take mobile phone photos. Village militant youth are unfamiliar with the internet, cannot afford relatively costly cyber cafe fees, and their faces are mostly unknown to the authorities, that's to the police and the military force, and so their violent operations are mostly undocumented. Their weapons are simple. About half the boys in the principal study village of RM own locally made rifles, pistols, long knives, swords, and thick sticks. But by the way, about 6 years ago, or 4 years ago, when I first started to do research on this, nobody had a gun that was actually in operational condition among the Birom Christians, and the Fulani were much the same. So the arming with modern weapons of these lads has actually taken place in the last 4 to 5 years. And they put a lot of their own money into it, and so that their farming systems are not, and their land is not being looked after, because the money that they get from their crops or from their carpentry or from their taxes and so on is going into weapons. As of October 2013, no one owned or used an AK, that's the Birom Christians, none of them used an AK-47. Their methods of attack are equally simple. Move after dark, take the Fulani settlement by surprise, use long knives when silence is extremely important, attack together in a quick rush forward, have all weapons to hand. Town-based Birom area boys and contract hitmen are better known to the police, but they too are busy, focused on daily needs to feed their families so that they can't be distracted by the internet, most more usually not functioning. Also, they need to avoid the security agents hiding in the town so as to secure successful income-generating operations at night. When they kick off, sometimes by day but more often at night, some hide these days, they didn't do it before but now they do it, some hide all or part of their face in fashionable global style balaclava head turbans. Occasionally, when flush with money, a few Birom youth may invest some of the cash burning their pockets in a popular dress item, indicating their status as hip-hop youth. That's modernity, so they're identifying them with modernity. Moving with the latest gender-crossing fashions in the market, they sport women's large pink hair combs stuck in their frizzy hair atop their heads. Faces adorned with bright yellow or white, large-rimmed, round-rimmed sunglasses called goggles. Village youth adopt poor relation gender-crossing dressing. In late 2013, I saw several youth, including my driver's second son, wearing thigh-length female dresses over tight black or red leggings, their hair barbed into hip-hop hairstyles popular in Barkin Ladi Town. In these and other ways, Birom Christian youth articulate a double articulation of identities that draw on the one hand on customary values important in the labor-intensive, non-capitalist and simple commodity production economies, and on the other hand, they draw on dress styles signifying a with-it modernity, popularly associated with the West, global capitalism, and a nominal kind of doffing of the cap, as it were, to gender equality. Pastors of churches like the Church of Christ in Nigeria, Kokin, convey in spiritual and pecuniary ways the church's approval of their boys' courage, bravery in extreme adversity, and fighting skills executed in the one God's name. Though the predominant overarching values for these village youth are ethnic, religious elements normally have a subordinate place. Command of a physical force and physical strength is very important Money is key to the leader of the group maintaining his position, but it does not predominate in the official identity of a youth group that is dedicated to protecting their community and attacking others for the sake of home protection and safety for their women and children. However, at the same time, many of the boys in this village youth group who are less important, who are not leaders, they're just kind of like followers. They engage in a lot of cattle rustling and petty armed robbery for capital accumulation. Money is therefore an important value in this, but officially it doesn't have kind of first place, but it's there and it's very significant. The same is true of the Fulani. I don't have time to go into that, but might like to ask questions in the discussion time. But at the foot soldier level, again, it's the same sort of thing as among the Christian youth. The Fulani youth also engage in robberies and cattle rustling of non-clan Fulani herds for their own capital accumulation. So money is an important value. And the practice is accumulation by dispossession. Everybody is dispossessing everybody else. For both groups, for the Fulani, the thing is that jihad is authorized by the one God, Allah, and it gives you redeeming religious knowledge, piety, and religious merit. So that's a bit like Boko Haram. But they also, ethnic values are equally important, because Fulani will stick to Fulani, and Christian Biron will stick to Christian Biron. And nobody will be trusted who is different from that and not known to them. But both groups believe in rapid movement on the ground, surprise attack. They use simple weapons, that's especially the Christian Biron youth, including locally made pistols and rifles. Also, the Christian Biron youth now use long knives, that's the Fulani long knife, for silent execution of the human target. But the Fulani youth are much better armed. And as I said, some of them have got AK-47s. They're hidden, I wasn't able to talk about this because there's lack of time, but they're hidden underneath the floor of the mosque with a carpet on top, so people say, and I believe it. They're quite consistent, these reports, over about the last 2 or 3 years. And also some of them, like this rocket launcher, are probably hidden somewhere in the bush. So they have the more sophisticated weapons. Now let me go on to Boko Haram. Okay, this is a woman working in one of the local tin mines, and she's washing the raw ore and separating the columbite from the basic tin. Here is Imam Ibrahim Shekau, which is assault rifle at the ready in about 2010. All of this is from the internet. Here is attributed to Boko Haram, probably 2012. The logo is in Arabic, but I don't know the identity of this group for certain. But this is quite clear. This is the Boko Haram commanders with Shekau in the bush. Shekau, by the way, is reported to have been killed twice, but he's still alive. note their lean bodies. Where are we now? That's it. Okay, that's the Niger Delta. So we'll go back one. There we are. Here he is, that's right, that's there. Okay, now I'm just going to have a quick look at the extreme Islamist organization, Boko Haram. On their part, Islamists, militia armies, and fundamentalist brotherhoods in northeastern Nigeria, and also now active in Plateau State, Nasarawa, Kaduna State, Taraba State, Adamawa, Abuja, the capital city of Nigeria. And at one time, about 3 years ago, they were also active in the far south, in the Niger Delta, in two towns called Sapele and Wori. So these organizations, now I'll just focus on Boko Haram, it highlights its modernity in historical and contemporary contexts when it implements in the one God's name, that's Allah's name, present and past just jihadist wars against infidels, kafiri, and corrupt governments. There's a huge literature now emerging about how the organization now called Boko Haram began and da 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 da. But basically, it began with a minority of radical Kanuri and Hausa youth in Bornu and Yobe states. The Kanuri had a big empire at one time, about 500 years ago, called the Kanuri Kanem Empire, and it was based upon the trans-Saharan slave trade between the black African populations south of the Sahara and the whiter-skinned populations north of the Sahara, including into Egypt. So a small number of radical Kanuri and Hausa youth were getting together in Bornu and Yobe states. And those were the two states in the far northeast, which were on the map. They got the same boundary. These pious Nigerian Kanuri and Hausa youth identified with the violence of Afghanistani Taliban in their struggles in their country, that's Afghanistan, for Sharia law and exclusion of women from formal education. Since 2000 and 2002, the Loose-Knit organization that became Boko Haram, Western education is forbidden, has evolved into an increasingly violent war against the state. Since 2010, Boko Haram under Imam Ibrahim Shekau has forged close alliance with extra-state jihadists. It is not totally clear, but very likely, that Boko Haram participates through and with its extra-state allies, that's Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and Al-Shabaab, in Sahelistan, or that's the Sahel, non-legal networks trafficking narcotics, arms, currencies, sex, and other goods criminalized by the state. The primary purpose of players in this non-legal, as in the legal political economy, is capital accumulation by dispossessing subalterns of their lives and entitlements under state law. An irony, of course, is that some of these people doing this in the non-legal as well as in the legal sector are actually subalterns themselves by origin, but after some time they get enough money and they're no longer subalterns, they become part of a kind of capitalist sort of class. Power in non-legal context belongs to the most ruthless, intelligent, and gifted in managing the financial, theological, and military needs of a revolutionary organization. The same is true of leadership in global non-legal trafficking networks, minus the theological factor, secular. However, Islamists like Ibrahim Shekau operate a financial necessity in a non-legal, extra-state world of extreme violence. But their jihadist mission to topple bourgeois pro-Western rule lies within the nation-state. So Boko Haram operates outside in order to get money from these non-legal trafficking networks in the Sahel, but they operate inside in terms of what they want to do, which is to have a revolution in terms of the political system being transformed into a revolutionary Islamic one inside Nigeria. Such religious leaders are driven initially, at least, not by economic greed, but by a personal belief in their divine mission. Accumulating capital is a means to the end of sustaining the war against the Nigerian state, not the primary objective. Whereas in the case of the Niger Delta, Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, the Ijaw group, militant group, actually accumulating capital is probably their primary aim. They want the oil for their state that they want to declare, an Ijaw state in the Niger Delta, but they also want the oil for themselves. I mean, they are exceedingly, how can I say, bourgeois, but they are also militants who want to overthrow the Nigerian state and have their own independent Ijaw state. They may also settle in the end for autonomy within a very loose-knit Nigerian confederation. But in the case of Boko Haram, at least at the moment anyway, it seems that accumulating capital is a means to the end. Whereas in the case of the Ijaw, Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta in the south of the country, capital accumulation and ethnic nationalism are the main driving values and concepts. A few reports suggest that Shekau believes, this is Boko Haram, jihad against corrupt regimes is ordained by the one God, Allah. State security forces who slay Boko Haram people are infidels, and so it is meritorious to kill them. Jihadist killing generates religious knowledge and merit for the killers. Driven like other men of extreme faith, Shekau sees himself as riding in from the desert, that's the bush, camps with his commanders and his mujahideen, rich in asabir, that's cohesion, in the 14th century historian, sociologist, Ibn Khaldun terms. They will continue to fell the corrupt state, their men seizing from bank vaults and palatial mansions, gold, cash, precious stones, livestock, and human beings, including children. It is likely that Imam Shekau, or the breakaway faction Ansaru's leader, is the model for Boko Haram and other Islamist cells scattered across Nigeria and beyond in some Sahelian states as northern Mali and Chad. These cells learn from Boko Haram's campaigns in northeast Nigeria and also across the border in Cameroon to do with kidnapping and ransoming for money, about the need for ruthless methods, including execution of all dissidents within the organization so as to keep control over their foot soldiers, that's their mujahideen, and their commanders. In this regard, reports about Boko Haram are suggestive. First, behave as a big man, a patron, and feed your men, that's your clients, with money, arms, religious knowledge, food, and women, many virgins, and so on. Second, only recruit into sensitive positions men from your own ethnic or sub-ethnic group. As a proud Kanuri, Shekau never trusts anyone who is Hausa to be anything more than a mujahideen or a suicide bomber. So in this respect, Boko Haram, like other such Islamist groups, is also influenced, though to a lesser extent, in their self-vision by ethnicity. And in this focus on trust as being within the ethnic group, or the sub-ethnic group, that's the clan, is the same as what the Biram Christian village youth and the area boys have in Plateau State. It's the same kind of focus. So Shekau comes over as part gangster, part intellectual, fluent in Kanuri, Arabic, and Hausa. Not English. He doesn't speak English, and that's quite deliberate. Equipped, he probably does, but he says that he doesn't. Equipped to solve problems by lethal use of the AK-47 and the computer. Though Boko Haram relies for global publicity on irregular posting of videos on YouTube, they used to have much more stuff on the internet, but now it's much more difficult because of the security forces and so on. He is said to believe that violence against infidels via jihad leads to religious knowledge in the morally right Quranic way. Shedding infidels' blood, whoever they are, civilians, soldiers or whatever, police and so on, grants jihadists like him grace. Yep, thank you. Keen on intimidating the bourgeois state and its perceived incompetent, highly corrupt and cowardly president, Shekau has declared to the world via YouTube that we enjoy killing infidels. We will take over the Nigerian state and impose Sharia law for an end to corruption and poverty through governance according to Allah's will, as revealed by the Prophet Muhammad in the Quran. Recently, in 2014, that's this year, he repeated his promise of earlier years to the immediate fury of Ijaw militant groups that Boko Haram would terrorize the Niger Delta and claim Nigeria's oil. Boko Haram's extremely bloody militarization of violence is evident in much publicized brand images released periodically of Shekau, the group's lean-looking imam. There's one of him flanked by several equally thin commanders. He's also photographed sitting on a throne-like chair or on the ground, wearing his characteristic Boko Haram version of the global jihadist headdress, perhaps an adaptation of the Taliban's Afghan or Peshawar turban. Maybe this is meant to remind us that following a quietistic beginning in the late 1990s, the Boko Haram group subsequently engaged in pro-Taliban, let us use violence phase to get arms and funds, attacking police stations, colonizing and terrorizing and killing villagers in two villages outside in Kano and Yobe states. Finally, I can't finish, so we'll just leave it for the discussion, but I just want to finish up on Shekau. Chief Executive and Military Supremo Imam Abu Bakr Shekau has twice been declared dead by the outwitted Nigerian security forces. That's in 2010 and 2013. He's a proscribed international terrorist. He has a US price on his head of $7 million for the organization or person securing his capture, dead or alive. Currently, he is presumed to be based across the Nigerian border in Cameroon, Chad, or Niger, permanently on the run. Nevertheless, his men have penetrated the state's institutions up to and inside the presidency, recently launching, that's about a month ago, what looks like an attempted coup from the Secret Service's Yellow House, right next to the President's Lodge. And I will end there. Thank you.
Caroline, as people think and organize their questions, I just want to make one comment and then ask two small questions. My comment is that for a Maltese audience, I think what might be most shocking, perhaps, about your presentation is that we know here in Malta that the Federal Republic of Nigeria, with its petroleum wealth and the largest population in sub-Saharan of any state in sub-Saharan Africa, is seen by the Western powers as a kind of local security bulwark and as a kind of a guarantee of stability, to use the Western expression.
Yes.
In not just West Africa, but Africa as a whole. And yet the picture you are presenting is for me also shocking as an old Nigeria hand, because unknown to me, you are presenting a picture of the collapse of the state, of the Nigerian state, which is supposedly the richest and most powerful African state, the collapse of the state in the rural areas, in ways with cross-gender dressing and all kinds of weird rituals that recall the appalling violence in Liberia and Sierra Leone in the 1990s. So I think that's shocking. But listening to you, one might wish to jump ahead from a theoretical point of view and just say, perhaps this is what we're going to have to get used to. We're going to have to get used to a post-state West Africa, or at least Sahelian Africa, in which all bets are off, and we simply have to reconfigure and re-envision what politics is all about in Africa. With that opening comment, just two small questions. The first is, I'm sure on many people's minds, what is it like for you, a woman, to do research in these dangerous, fieldwork in these dangerous areas? And secondly, perhaps you can comment on why you were always pointing to the significance of the lean bodies.
Okay, so, I mean, you're right about, okay, there's three things there. Then there's the collapse of the, the conventional nation state with its institutions functioning. And you're right. I mean, the Western powers and the global financial institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, NATO, the American president, the British Prime Minister and so on, they all promote this image of Nigeria as the bulwark of stability. And I've actually got a section on that, but there was too much. But basically, the Nigerian government is becoming very expert now at promoting that kind of image, which then reinforces what, let's say, like think tanks are doing in Washington and what they're producing, etc. So there's that conflict, but the reality is, at least in the north and the center of Nigeria, and to some extent in parts of Yoruba land in the southwest, which are furthest from Lagos, there are similar kind of, I did some work recently for about 2 weeks in a village which produces a lot of shea nut, shea butter and shea butter oil. And there was a lot of poverty there. It's the same sort of picture. And the youth, these area boys, they were very quiet when I was there. But because I've been around a bit for a long time, I thought, wow. So I asked my driver. So he confirmed my picture, my understanding. And yes, I mean, they were all around me, but they were being very obedient. And because they were hoping to benefit from the focus group discussions, because I gave everybody who took part in these things about 2,000 naira each. So for them, that's actually a lot of money.
Which is about how much?
2,000 naira is about, it's about £10, which is about what? About $14 or something, or $15? Yeah. And for the women in, okay, that's that village down there. They were just so delighted, these women in particular. The youths were, it was all right. But, well, you know, I mean, what they're like. But they were okay with it. The elders were also delighted, because they don't go to farm anymore in that particular village. Then there's another village in Kano, which was much, much more serious, to do with collapse of the state.
Kano is in the far north, and it's far the main north. City of northern Nigeria.
Let me get this. Kano there? Can't see. Is that Kano?
Yes.
Should be. Yeah. So we did about week to 10 days work in a village about 50 kilometres, 30 kilometres, I think it was south of Kano or southwest of Kano. And that was the nearest thing that we had to having a very, very serious problem. These boys were all there, about 50 of them. I thought, what's happening? As our old car, Peugeot station wagon, kind of rolled up. And my driver is a big man and very black, and he put on his kind of Muslim Hausa man type garb for the day. And he's used to all of this kind of moving around and everything. But he looked around. He didn't say anything to me because I'm a woman and he didn't want to frighten me. So, I mean, I'm thinking like him now. This is what he's thinking. I go look after her. I go protect her. So, he then starts to talk, and the elders are sort of, there's about five or seven elders wearing very, very unclean cloths, because they only have about two cloths, one for the week and one for Friday Jumat prayers, these elders. So they're in their little mud mosque, and they're like this. And that's extraordinary, because the elders should be coming out to greet me on behalf of their village and to introduce me. And my driver, and the other man, we had another man, a Muslim friend of ours, who is very good as well at this kind of thing. He's not very well educated, but my golly, he's good at this kind of work. So he was with us as well, Usman, but he's like half Fulani, and he's very, very short and thin, so they didn't take much notice of him, you know. So the elders were really, really nervous because of these 50 type, about 50 sort of area boy type lads. So anyway, my driver then handled them. He became very, very bossy indeed. So I then started to ask him, I said, what's going on? Why are you so bossy? You know, this is not a good thing to do. He said, Ma, he said, make you go now. So he put me through the one of the houses, a courtyard and everything, into the women's area. So that's where I did my women's focus group discussion. Then our friend Usman, who was with us, this half Fulani, he then did the one with the elders, and my driver took the one with the youth. And it was really, there was nobody there. They could have done anything. And indeed, while we were doing all of these sort of talking for about 2 hours and everything, and doing the focus group discussions, etc., these youths had apparently had got into the back of the car. Because when we got into the car to go off in a big hurry, I can tell you, they was all still there. They didn't benefit much at all. A few of them, I employed about three of these lads, area boys, to do some of their questioning and answering and so on. So it's to keep them quiet and give them 2,000 naira each. So, but when we shut off, I said to Imar, after about 2 or 3 minutes, why is that boot hanging out? You know, it's banging. He said, Ma, they broke the lock on the boot and they were going to enter. But then I think they found that the car, they didn't have a key which matched that kind of ignition, because it's a very old vehicle. So that was a bit fortunate. So that was our closest, in that particular trip last year, that was our closest sort of shave. But I've been in other situations in which, you know, as a woman, you were asking me about that, what is it like? That was in 2011. In a guest house, about 10 kilometers outside of Barkin Ladi, in the bush, I'm with three elderly securities, one of them who was a retired soldier, and it's a Christian-type guest house, so, you know. And he had an old Deng gun, that was his main weapon. The other two of them had a catapult each. That's their means of protecting everybody in the guest house against possible attack. So at that particular time, there were no soldiers there then. So anyway, for about 3 weeks, there was fighting as the Fulani from, there's a hill behind the guest house. Anyway, the Fulani were hiding behind, because they had a village and a settlement quite close by at the top of that hill. They were hiding behind this hill and then coming down the hill at night. And I can tell you, it was quite scary. But anyway, if you've got plenty of blood and it's on the floor in front of me, I'll feel all kind of weak. But when it's bullets, somehow it's okay. I don't know why. So so what is politics? I think you said, what is politics all about?
That was my broad comment, but may I ask about the lean bodies? Because I'm
Lean bodies, because in Nigeria, and I think you know this very well, it's very important eating, and it's very important to have a big body to look strong. And also, if you're going to be a woman on your own, you need a driver who has a big neck. This is very much an Igbo thing from the south, is to have a big neck. But also the Biram are getting increasingly keen on the big neck, and so is everybody else, actually, because it suggests that you've got real power in your body with a big neck and you're very well fed. You've got flesh on you. Whereas these Boko Haram guys look pretty lean to me and thin. Whereas the Niger Delta ones, these Ijo that we didn't have time to have a look at, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND, they're all, most of them are very large indeed. Some of them have real pot bellies. And the commanders...
Pot bellies? Yes.
They're drinking beer, they're drinking palm wine, they're drinking this, they're drinking that, they're eating meat every single day. I'm speaking like a Nigerian now, because the emphasis on meat, you know, if you can eat meat once a week, you're doing very well. Some of these villages which have been impacted very badly by violence in Plateau State, and I'm sure it's the same in northeastern Nigeria, very much so. They only eat meat now twice a year, that's at Easter and Christmas. These are Christian villages. So eating leanness and fatness and the neck is very important.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much and commend you for your very, very subtle and wide discussion. I was wondering, you mentioned that, you know, to a certain extent you're adopting a Marxist framework, and I was wondering whether, although that could perhaps help explain why we're dealing with perhaps a failed state with a sort of robber oligarchy at the top, I'm wondering whether it actually captures the complexity of what you're dealing with. I mean, it seems to me that actually what you were talking about was a large number of different actors, a large number of different types of struggles with different aims, very traditionalist in some respects. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, even in a so-called religious movement like Boko Haram, nevertheless, everything is embedded in a type of trust, ethnicized trust. Partly also very traditionalist types of action. I mean, you know, Fulani being pastoralists, I mean, the interesting thing about pastoralists is that they're always state resistant and always very good at moving goods around. So now, of course, it's extended into drugs and so on. So it seems to me, you know, what actually seems to be taking place, at least from what I understood from your very complex presentation, is it's never been a very, very integrated state. There's always been this big difference between the North and the South, which has further become even much more micro-ethnicized. They don't act as classes in themselves or for themselves at all. And it's just, you know, sort of regional conflicts, partly coordinated perhaps with the Fulani who were excluded and then wants to get some land and so on and so forth, because they weren't part of the sort of way how the state organized production and so on. So that's my sort of interpretation of what you were sort of presenting. But I don't know whether, you know, you would agree whether a capitalist or, you know, a Marxist approach is suitable for this. That's what I have problems with.
I like what you said very much. It's really good. And I only wish that other people who write about these conflicts in, like, there are some Nigerian journalists who are very, very perceptive, but there are many who are just taken over by the states, the presidency's kind of propaganda and image making. And what you've said is absolutely right. It's excellent. But the problem is that why I've adopted or tried to adopt and somehow sort of to keep it moving through this popular quasi-Marxist notion of accumulation by dispossession, although that's in Marx himself, but people like David Harvey have made much, as we all know, have made much more of it. But why I've adopted that approach is to try and get rid of this sort of ephemeral, kind of neoliberal, kind of superficial so-called analysis in which you just operate within people's stated versions of what they're thinking, of how they see their lives and so on. And I'm not saying that they're wrong, because that's important to them. But as a sociologist or anthropologist, kind of supposed sort of analyst, I think one should be able to do better and try and get kind of beyond it and down deep into the social formation and what's actually happening there. That's why I've adopted that kind of approach. But it's, to some extent, it's really difficult in a sort of a public talk or a lecture or an academic article type word-limited paper to actually do it, because you haven't got enough words to be able to explain about this concept and to make it more nuanced. Let's say, like, that whole contrast between the capitalist class and the subalterns, is non-capitalist and simple commodity production relations, and then advanced capital intensive, not labor dependent, really sort of type operations of the oil and the gas companies, in which a lot of it is operations are kind of computerized. It's too simple. But on the other hand, it gives a broad kind of framework, because there is so much exploitation and accumulation, and everybody is accumulating through everybody else, if you know what I mean. Anybody gets a chance, like the armed robbery, the on the roads, for example. I mean, to actually enable me, I have to have great patience and kind of tolerance to try and control my driver, because every few kilometers, let's say, like going from Jos to Kano, which is north of Plateau, we're stopped on the roads by so-called vigilante groups, or masquerading as vigilantes, but really they're all robbers. So, I mean, you're absolutely right, it's extortion, robbery, and people put on different kinds of uniform and dressing, which is why these images from the internet of these different Islamist groups are actually very important. And the trouble is, I myself don't have photographs of this for the Birom and the local kind of fieldwork area type thing, because it's too dangerous.
Would you see that as a type of masquerade and secret societies?
Yes.
In a way, it's a sort of modern masquerade and secret societies Mark II.
That's right. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Peter.
Thanks. I admire the complexity of the situation. I appreciate that. And you've done it, Also, the booty aspect, booty capitalism, which is related to primitive, it's very obvious there. My question concerns the global. And the sense I got is actually that the local interacts with the global in the sense of Al-Qaeda, Al-Quds, all these sudden movements. So there's a sudden ring to the larger movements with which they are connected. But I just wonder, I don't know anything about Nigeria, but I wonder if the West also plays a role in this. That's my question. Given we all know the arms industry, which is very Western dominated, now it probably gets there via these movements. Lots of countries after the Cold War wanted to get rid of their armaments and were selling them to Africa.
Absolutely.
So you may want to comment on that.
Well, thank you very much for that question. That is also a very good one. And it gets at the heart of some of the power processes which are going on and the Western involvement. I mean, it's true about the arms, and like these industries, like for Britain, I think arms exports are number two as income earners, I think. And for arms exports, I think, for Britain, are number two as income earners for the state, British state. And the same for the US. You're absolutely... And Israel?
Israel, the fourth major exporter.
Yeah, there we are. Israel certainly... And thank you for... That's right. Israel is a player in Nigeria in the sense that about 18 months ago to 2 years ago, in Plateau State, an Israeli company, and it's doing this, by the way, in other states, but I just know about it at a personal level, fieldwork level for a Plateau State. They set up and they have a contract with the Plateau State government to transform smallholder peasant agriculture in Plateau State and to enable them to produce more maize, corn, guinea corn, potatoes, and strawberries and so on. So an Israeli company is doing that, and they have a contract to train local farmers and to give them seeds, quality seeds, so that they've got tomato plants, for example, I've seen inside their plastic greenhouses, which go right up to the ceiling. I mean, all of that is completely irrelevant to local farmers, and some of the stuff is genetically modified, I'm sure. So Israel is actually a very active player now in Nigeria. President Goodluck Jonathan recently went to Israel on a Christian pilgrimage. His vice president went to Mecca on the Hajj. Other Western players, like the British, are very much there, but I think their focus is DFID, Department for International Aid and Development. And they do aid in Nigeria, so-called aid, but it's basically linked to business in the sense that DFID has to purchase all of its, as you know, all of its cars and everything else from British car manufacturers stroke sellers. Well, not many manufacturers left. Then the Americans. America is an important player in the Nigerian situation, and they seem to be the most concerned about the military strategic disintegration of the country. And most, fit all of the semi-confidential or confidential kind of news alerts that I've been getting from one or two friends of mine actually come from the US. They set up, as you know, probably a military organization called AFRICOM, Africa Command. And the Americans, this happened about 5 years ago, the Americans, they started it then, they wanted AFRICOM, Africa Command, to be based in Senegal, in Dakar. And the Senegalese said, "Now, wow, no way." And they went to Ghana, thinking that little Ghana would say yes, you see, because Ghana's small and, you know, who cares about Ghana, really, you know. But Ghana now has oil, so it's a bit different. But at that time, the oil was just about beginning, and they just had the gold exports from the Ashanti goldfields. So went to Ghana. Ghana was terrified. "What? You want to have Africa Command in the middle of our country? God, no, no, no." So they went to Nigeria, thinking then that Cote d'Ivoire said no. And anyway, they were doing their civil war at that time, so it wasn't possible. So they went to Nigeria, thinking that Abuja would welcome them with open arms. But even the Nigerians, they had a look around the rest of Africa and said, "Oh, everybody's saying no, so we're going to say no as well." But actually, they've got AFRICOM there. So the Americans have got Africa Command, and then they've now got drone launching pads, surveillance, supposedly only surveillance drones. Algeria, this is in West Africa, Algeria, Senegal, Mali, and Niger, right on the northeastern border, just right on the border with Bornu State in the northeast of the country. There is a drone pad now. Africa Command has its headquarters, African headquarters, in Djibouti. And they have, I presume that they have a short helicopter landing strip and other things like that. They've also given, somebody has given a whole lot of jet fighters to the Nigerian Air Force. They didn't have them 2 years ago, but they've now got them, and they've been recently bombing Boko Haram camps in northeastern Nigeria and killing a whole lot of civilians. Mm-hmm. So the Americans, they also have, I think they have a drone pad as well, probably in Kenya, somewhere in eastern Africa. So they are, they're the ones who are really, really concerned about the strategic importance of Nigeria and its potential collapse. Because certainly, although when you're there, I've been telling Paul, you know, just don't worry too much. I mean, the country, in a sense, you can go there and you can still move around as long as you're careful and don't go to areas where there's a lot of fighting, obviously, going on, and conflict and so on. So, but the institutions, it's like a kind of a tent, like the outer structure is there, but inside it's hollowed out by patrimonial corruption, patron clientship, and mega accumulation. Like, just, sorry, one final little story on that, on accumulation, is that the minister responsible for coordinating the national economy, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, an Igbo Christian, and close to Goodluck Jonathan, the president. She recently was given a leadership award by the in economics by the Rockefeller Foundation. And I believe that this is a cover-up for the fact that she has presided over the loss of, originally it was $40 billion US dollars from the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, which hadn't remitted it to the Central Bank of Nigeria. Who blew the whistle? The governor, Sanusi Lamido Sanusi, who is a member of the Kano ruling emirate.
He was then... The governor of Lagos State or Niger Delta State?
The governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, yeah. He blew the whistle and said that he hasn't received... the accounts and the money it's worth about $40 billion. Where is it? So then a journalist, he leaked it. He wrote to President Jonathan, reported all of this, and said, this is my third or fourth letter to you now in the last 18 months, and nothing has been happening. You haven't done anything about it. Please do something about it. Otherwise, I'm going to have to act. So nothing happened. So he did. He leaked it to one of the newspapers, and then all hell started to break loose. So, and a lot of talk. So the... Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, the minister presiding over the national economy, and the Minister for Petroleum and Resources, Alison Madueke, Desiani Madueke, another kind of like Igbo, she's a sort of Niger Delta type person, but north of the Delta. Anyway, she was the minister then directly responsible for the loss of these $40 billion. She then started to scurry around, and they managed to produce $20 billion. It took about two or three weeks. But Sanusi Lamido Sanusi, the governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, who's been highly respected, by the way, by international institutions dealing with finance and money, he then said, and he put it to the press, and they all reported it faithfully, he said that that's not the point. The point is the procedure, the process. How come now that we've now got back $20 billion US dollars? But what about the other $20 billion? And where did you get all this $20 billion from that you've now remitted back to the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation for onward submission to the Central Bank of Nigeria. So, but this Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, she then rushed off to America, saw her friends in Rockefeller Foundation and the World Bank and the IMF and everything, and they gave her this Leadership in Economics Award.
Carolyn, thanks for the great presentation. It was really fascinating. I'll try to keep this very quick, but as you were talking and as Paul Clough and Paul Sancassia were describing first Paul as the collapse of the state and Paul Sancassia actually asking you about the real applicability of a Marxian perspective on what, after all, may not actually be a state in the first place in a traditional sense. I was thinking about Umberto Eco's comments about our entering a new Middle Ages and thinking about this issue of the dispossessing of others of their means of production, and in the sort of the medieval sense in which goods are sequestered by a small group of people at the vast expense and maldistribution of goods of a small group of elites. But in a way, this doesn't really capture the kind of situation that you're talking about, because today it's not just the maldistribution of goods, it's actually the disappearance of resources, that is to say, you know, of flight capital, and the fact that actually the place of production has nothing to do with where those resources actually end up, and that you therefore have people who, once they have access to resources, join that global scene that you described. So what this leads me to ask about is what happens with, for example, these Biram and the Biram gang. How is this affected by Quit and these cults of animism and these actions that actually tie them quite specifically to a particular place and, in fact, disenfranchise them from participating in the kind of flight activities that good capitalists know how to engage in very well, especially the banking business?
Do you understand what...
Yes. Well, I mean, they're not really... I really like those comments as well, and I didn't know that Umberto Eco had made this sort of, has got these sort of thoughts about entering the new Middle Ages, yes. But then the flight capital, it's a disappearance of resources, you're saying. It's quite right. Not just, it's the maldistribution, but also the disappearance. So the Biram, these Christians, it's really quite interesting because in an ethnography written by somebody called Audrey Smedley, who Paul knows about, the book came out in about 2004, but she did her fieldwork in 1959 to 1961 among the Biram. She stressed how they were already experiencing serious problems to do with land, but they just kind of stuck with their remaining bits of land and their massive population growth, etc. They stuck with that. And they weren't even very active in the tin mines, but as the tin mining went on by about the 50s, they had begun to become more involved and they were laboring in it. But small-scale farming, small-scale money. And really, even now, I mean, look, it's only these people that I know from upper and middle plateau who are Biram, who I know. But it seems that they're all... They don't take a big part in anything that's going to get them reasonable kind of financial rewards. They're not even really involved in any significant way, apparently, in the non-legal economy of body part trafficking. I mean, they'll dig out the parts, but then they hand them over to some Hausa man or Fulani boy who's actually then going to hand them on to those maybe who will be grinding them down and making them into dry powder. Because the chief... Is this still running?
Yes, it's still working.
Oh, okay. Yes, because there's a radical cleric in Barkin Ladi, and he's also a herbalist. He's an extreme Islamist, and he's a herbalist. And it may be, but I'm here just speculating, that he also has a hand in the grinding down of the body parts into fine powder. So from babies, from women, from men, I mean, there are plenty of corpses after any of this fighting. But also some people are now deliberately being killed, like one individual will be killed, and his head will then be cut off or parts of his body will be removed. Now, it could be that whoever is doing that, it's a Fulani sometimes, it's a Biram another time, it's just kind of malicious or revenge, but it's also to make money, and my informants are very, very serious about that. So that it's it's the Hausa Fulani, definitely for the body parts, kind of like value-adding further on down the line by the grinding into fine powder of the flesh and the bones and everything else. And the Biram, they may dig out body parts, and they do. And there are even some photographs of Christian youth actually eating fresh or freshly roasted body parts. I know. But that's when they're high on drugs, marijuana, beer, and also you see amphetamines are made locally now as well.
Thank you.
So.
I'd like to ask a question about the women in all this. I mean, it has nothing to do with this situation, but I remember that when in Tunisia suddenly there were these jihadists who were going off to Syria to fight, the biggest reaction was from the women who were trying to stop them. And actually physically going off to the airport to try and stop the men from leaving. And I was just wondering, given you were also describing very much the clothing, I was wondering what clothing the women are being made to wear, because in extreme Islamism, suddenly the women are being made to wear more and more clothing and more covering. And I was wondering, from the female point of view, what is happening? I mean, are the women sort of passively taking all this? Are they reacting? Are they participating?
Well, thank you very much for that excellent question and the description of the women trying to stop their men going on jihad to Syria or wherever. The Biram Christian women, they remain in their kind of lapis, and they usually wear a head tie, but that's kind of quite traditional. The Fulani women are becoming more and more covered up. because their husbands are often radical Islamic clerics, or else they're more kind of quiet, but they're still traditionalist and increasingly pious and conservative. So they insist on their women being covered. Women married to Muslims in Plateau State that I found, and in Kano State, they can't leave their houses without the permission of the husband. And they live in great poverty and hunger. Yeah. Because the husband is the one who goes out and buys the food and all the rest of it. So there's much more of that now than there was about 10 years ago. And it's actually very sad for women. But women in the among the Christian Birom, they are important as peacemakers still. And you saw them, you know, how they're wailing and everything like that. And the men really took a lot of notice of those particular demonstrations by women of their grief for their lost children, their lost husbands, and so on. The women among the Fulani, the Muslim communities, it's just, it's what you're suggesting. It's just more and more conservatism and less political, sort of possible political potency. It's not good. But in the rest of Nigeria, of course, like in the Christianized South, things, you know, move on as before, and much less of this conservative type stuff. It's much more in the north and the center.
Caroline, thank you very much for an extremely rich talk. Thank you.
I'd just like to say thank you very much for coming and for listening to me. And I know that it's difficult because it's Nigeria and it's not close to Malta and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, you're close to North Africa. So, but I've been privileged to be able to give some of my kind of attempts to interpret this very complex and difficult material. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled In God's Name, Primitive Accumulation and Power Wars in West Africa Today. The talk was delivered by Dr. Caroline Ifeka.